Hi everyone, and welcome to our first podcast for the Privacy Impact Shop, where we're going to be talking about all things privacy, data protection, what it means to businesses, and what it means to individuals as well. My name's Shahbal Baghdadi, Head of Data Protection at Blackfoot UK and GDPRIE, and I'd like to introduce my good friend and work colleague, Ben Stevens.
So I'm Ben Stevens, as Shahb said. I'm Commercial Director at Blackfoot and GDPR.ie. So my role within the business, you know, I'm responsible for essentially the relationship between ourselves and all of our customers, our marketing and our sales. We have a lot of conversations and you know, we talk a lot through work, and I think it's, you know, a good opportunity for us to get together and you know, record some content that we can share and put out there.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things to say as well is we're going to be having, you know, a lot of guests coming on as we sort of roll these out. We've obviously got some ideas of what's going on in the market, what's actually happening. So not just the theory of data protection and privacy, but what's really happening on the ground there. And we want to get your feedback, what's happening, what's important to you, what you want to know about. So that's important to us as well. Ben,
I think one of the things I see a lot, I meet with a lot of customers. One thing that connects all of those conversations is, you know, the common theme, the common question is, what are you seeing elsewhere? And that's something we can easily bring to the table through this forum. You know, in terms of sharing ideas, what's happening out there, you know, we've got insight into a lot that's going on that we can share, and I think it's useful information and valuable insight. That people really, you know, it's the primary question that I get all the time.
It is really worth understanding that, you know, when we, as an organisation or organisations, and we'll talk more about that a bit later in another podcast, what we're actually finding is we're not just sector specific. And what I mean by that is people say, oh, are you mainly in banking? Are you mainly in retail? Well, if it's personal data, you're kind of everywhere. Mm. So we play in, you know, so many verticals, from tech startups looking to come into the market, and as you rightly say, large international organisations with jurisdictions, you know, trying to manage global data protection laws and regulations.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think a good place to start, actually, is like, how do we know each other? Where did our paths cross? And we've known each other for, I think, just over 10 years now.
Is it?
Yeah, it is 10 years, yeah. I had to check my LinkedIn. Yeah, when I started.
That's the basis of our friendship, LinkedIn. Yeah.
Okay. But as you can tell, it is a friendship. You know, we work and we're friends, you know, and we have been for a long time now. So, yeah, back in 2014, I think we first met.
Wow.
At Blackfoot. And that's where our paths initially crossed. And,
yes.
No looking back, right?
Well, no looking back, probably because my eyesight's going. So a little bit of maybe a background then, a little bit of background story here. I think we pretty much joined at the same time, didn't we, Ben?
About 3 months apart.
Was that it? Mm. Well, okay. Yeah. So we were both at Blackfoot. I was starting more and more to find it very interesting around data protection and privacy, and a little bit of that had been sort of, my interest had been pricked, shall we say, whilst I was at IBM. And, you know, we were starting, IBM had a sort of quite a big drive around data protection and privacy. So when I moved to Blackfoot initially, they sort of gave me that sort of, you know, and this is one of the great things about Blackfoot, is that they give you a bit of free rein to, you know, take the ball and run with it if you've got an idea. So we were building out data protection offering solutions. I think, to be fair, Ben, would you say we were a little bit early to the market?
I think we were, certainly in certain sectors at the time where we were probably stronger in. So, you know, you go back and look at Blackfoot as an organization, it really started out, you know, 2008, really focusing on the protection of cardholder data. And I think because of that, even still to this day, we've still got a heavy presence within the retail sector. So was retail on a broad scale ready for ready for discussions around data protection? GDPR was coming down the track. Everyone was interested in hearing about it. I don't think everyone was interested in actually doing something about it. So we were quite early. I believe we were. Yeah.
Yes, I would absolutely agree on that. Mm. So, you know, GDPR was coming. It was that sort of, how can you put it? It was the train that was coming down the tunnel and the lights were getting closer and closer and you could hear it whistling. But there were other trains in the platform which needed to be dealt with. So we were sort of having these discussions around data protection and and guess what? People had other issues to deal with. So I kind of, through mutual agreement, decided to leave Blackfoot, go off and set up a company which was online DPO. We then built that up. But even during that time, I was still working very closely with Blackfoot and supporting Blackfoot. And Blackfoot, we were doing training, consultancy, advisory work as well, sort of much broader data protection services. Do you want to say what happened next about how, that relationship then sort of came back and,
I think, it's about opportunities come and go. And I think an opportunity arose, 3 or 4 years ago. We were delivering quite a bit of our data protection services in-house. There was a bit of shift with that. And I think the opportunity arose to then really partner up with yourself as someone we've known, we used to employ as a business and we known and obviously trust you. So it just felt like the right time to kind of partner up with you and just, really contract more work to you around our, our data protection. And I think it worked really well and worked for a long period of time until more recently where a new opportunity arose and it was the right thing to do. And we can come on to that. But yeah, it worked well. We put you into a number of our customers and, you were able to deliver, effective and efficient services, to our customers. And, we were really happy with that.
Absolutely. And I think, and thank you for that. I think one of the, where that came about, and this was, the catalyst, it's almost like this sort of stars all aligned at the same time. So, there was this increase in organizations wanting data protection, Blackfoot existing clients. And then we had an opportunity for an acquisition, which we grabbed with both hands, and we're building on that. And there were two acquisitions there. One is still, we'll be talking about that later. But certainly the acquisition of GDPRIE was a big motivator for us to really start to combine resources and come together. And that is where we are now. And it's a very dynamic market, I would suggest, in data protection. There's a lot going on. And I think we'll probably move on to that. Maybe some of the things in the moment that are actually happening in data protection and privacy. What's, topical at the moment, some sort of cases that we're seeing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, look forward to coming on to that. I think with GDPR.ie, see, it's a recently announced acquisition. Something that we're all super proud of, and a lot of work has gone into that, certainly from ourselves and other key stakeholders within Blackfoot as well. It is a lot of work to kind of do that and make that happen and get a deal like that across the line. I think it's worth talking about for sure. And how did that come about? How did it land on the table, and what are the things we did to get that across the line, and what are we doing with it now?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, GDPRIE, just to sort of a bit of background, as we have already sort of mentioned, I was already doing some contract work with Blackfoot. And I was also doing some contract work for GDPRIE and supporting those guys as well, the people behind that organization. And during that sort of, and it was... only just before Christmas 2023, wasn't it? So it's not that long ago.
No. It feels like a lifetime.
It does, it does.
A lot's happened.
Well, the turkey dinner hasn't subsided. That's still sitting with me. But the point is that, as things were happening, they had decided to sort of move on with other opportunities. So they were saying, look, do you want to purchase this? And at the same time, we were having discussions about combining our resources, which made a perfect fit because previous to sort of really, sort of embedding back into Blackfoot, we didn't have that sort of information security expertise, which is, you know, one of the cornerstones of a Blackfoot capability. So it sort of all came together where, you know, during that sort of period, you know, we were buying an organization, selling an organization, you know, bringing it all together. So it was a pretty frantic sort of December, January, probably going into February. And then, obviously, once we bought that and, you know, sort of brought these sort of three pieces together, it was very much then about, what are we going to do with this? Because there's such a strong base. It's such a dynamic and interesting market, the Irish market.
Yeah.
If you think about the tech companies that are set up there,
Direct
access into the EU, you know, great workforce, close borders to the UK with, you know, all its great legal framework, etc. So it's a really exciting place to be.
Yeah.
Very dynamic, I'd suggest.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where we were. And we just spent a lot of time building that technical capability up. And then it's about what services we're bringing into play. Now, I don't think we're going to talk about that right here because, well, certainly not today. But, you know, it's one of those, you know, it's one of those areas where it's kind of understanding what people want, what people need, and then being able to deliver that, I think.
Yeah, there's a lot of opportunity, and albeit, you know, we've spent quite a bit of time understanding the GDPR.ie market, you know, what types of organizations they've typically supported in the past. And actually, it's got a global following. You know, we've spent quite a lot of time looking at the type of followers and demographics and customers that they deal with. Yes, it, you know, it's an Irish domain, it's an Irish website and business, but with a global following, it absolutely supports, you know, our mission in continuing to support, you know, our global clients.
You know what, Ben, I think that's one of the reasons why we're doing this. So we're, you know, what this is about is discussing the topics that people are talking to us about, what we're talking to businesses about, and, you know, we're bringing people into this to talk about what they've done, where, you know, what's worked, what hasn't worked, you know, what's been great, what's been, like, you know, something you'll never touch again. And the reason for that is, I think that's why we've got such, you know, a great interactive audience there, is because we're trying to give as much insight, and I'm not keen on the word too much, but thought leadership around what's happening in data protection and privacy, because it's one of those topics, it's not going anywhere.
Yeah, absolutely. Good stuff. All right. What's been going on? What's been happening out there?
Well, a lot. In terms of data protection, and a really interesting one at the moment is what's happened with the CEO of Telegram, the platform provider. Ben, tell me what you know about that, and then we can have a discussion in terms of what I think, what that means.
Well, first of all, I think I want to make it clear. I don't want to get political. That's not the purpose of what we're doing here. And you know, you have to consider that there may be, certainly with Telegram and the CEO being, you know, arrested, a billionaire, Russian billionaire being arrested in Paris. You know, if we just take the privacy stance on this, you've got an application that, you know, that supports all sorts of communications, whether it be criminal, nefarious, or totally legit, you know, and you have to think about that in a way that, yes, there's an angle of free speech, but in addition, you know, if the application, which I think we all know is, uses and supports crime, suffering, and those kind of things, then, you know, surely something has to be done. It's a balance, isn't it, between freedom of speech and you know, those sorts of rights versus, you know, is this an application that's fueling all sorts of bad things.
Do you know what? And I think that's the crux of it. And that's one of these issues that always comes up in data protection. And maybe, you know, after we've discussed a couple of topics in terms of what's going on out there now, we'll come on to that subject. But it is this balance. You know, if you look at a European perspective, it is around your fundamental rights and freedoms. Which means, where is that kind of balance between your right to freedom of expression and your right to a private life. And obviously, you know, the French authorities feel that Telegram has not got that balance right. I think what's also interesting on that is not necessarily that it's a GDPR piece as such. I think if you look at it, what it was brought under was the Direct Marketing Act and what organisations need to do, which are large providers of services.
Yeah.
So this is in terms of a Digital Marketing Act. Now, that's kind of in play now. It applies to organisations that have full... Well, it applies to anyone that's providing digital services. Mm. And it allows individuals to take action a lot easier. The interesting thing is that the most stringent requirements apply to the large sort of platform providers and digital services if you've got 45 million visitors a month or more. So, Ben, I think we might be up there quite soon. That's why
if
I mentioned
not,
it.
If not already.
If not already.
If not already.
Yeah.
But we'll see.
So, you know, that was the issue there, that, you know, it was under that they weren't putting enough protections in. And it kind of poses that question, doesn't it? Where, you know, I'm not picking on any particular platform before I get barred from anyone, you know, so whether it's X or whether it's, you know, Facebook or whether it's Telegram, and I'm not here to kind of, you know, give a specific, my personal opinion on any of those platforms. However, if you do look at them, it's when do they have to abide by the rules, i.e. as gatekeepers to services, and when do these large organisations actually become rule makers because they're so powerful? And that's what, you know, the concern really around this, you know, Digital Marketing Act and digital marketing content requirement legislation, which our friend, you know, who owns Telegram, is kind of foul of, really.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting one, I think. Yeah, watch this space with that.
Absolutely.
You know, I think it's very much ongoing from what I understand. So we'll see.
Yeah. What else is interesting at the moment? What's your view on the Uber piece? The Uber fine.
Do I think they are, you know, treating the personal data correctly and fairly? Probably not. I think as an individual, I think the law has its view, hence the Dutch authorities have fined them, you know, a significant amount of money. Will they pay it? I doubt it. I think it's going to go into court and roll around in court for a number of years, which is a cost in itself, obviously. So, you know, and will they end up paying it anyway? Well, time will tell. I can't see that Uber are going to just roll over and pay that fine. I just don't see that happening.
290 million?
Yeah, euros, yeah.
Yeah.
It's not small change. I think it works out about 1% of their annual revenue. So it's a huge number.
Well, if you think, well, I mean, it's 1%, but the regulation could have gone up to 4% if they wanted.
Yeah.
So on the GDPR two-tier fining kind of mechanism, you can go... 2%, 10 million euros or 2%, or 20 million euros or 4%. And the Dutch authority decided to use the lower tiering. What's interesting to me about this case is not necessarily the sort of headline figure, you know, 290 million, because let's be honest, they're a multi-billion company, you know, is it gonna hurt them too much? Probably not too badly, I would have said. But it's the third time the Dutch supervisory authority has, you know, gone after Uber on a fine. And what I find really kind of interesting about this is how this came about. So this whole case came about because 170 French taxi drivers were complaining about the fact that their data wasn't being protected when it was being transferred over to the US. Now, this is kind of and why I think this is interesting, because so many of our clients have always been, you know, and it's, you know, becoming more and more topical and more of an issue. How do you deal with data transfers international data transfers, because the regulation is really kind of, you know, quite stringent on this. And there's a lot of obligations around this. So if you think about it, these were 170 French taxi drivers made a complaint to the French Human Rights Organization. Yeah. They took it to CNIL. CNIL took it to the Dutch Protection Authority, and they investigated it, and they were the ones that imposed a fine. Yeah. Yeah. Why is that interesting? Because it means that it really highlights and shows that even if you're an organization based in one jurisdiction, if you're, what you're doing affects individuals in another jurisdiction, it, they can come, you know, it can affect you.
Do you see that happening with the UK market?
It could do.
Yeah.
It could do.
Could or will, likely to.
Well, look, I mean, currently under the, you know, framework where we have an adequacy decision.
Yeah.
Then, yes, absolutely, it could, you know, there is, you know, the possibility for it to happen. And if you want to look at where that would be something that could happen, you just need to go back to British Airways.
Yeah.
Mm. So that data breach affected people sort of kind of globally.
Yeah.
And therefore, it opened up the door for other authorities and individuals in other countries to go to those authorities like CNIL in France, etc., to, you know, say, OK, ICO in the UK or Data Protection Commissioner in Ireland, what are you going to do about this? Mm. Obviously, there's less alignment because, you know, we're not part of the, you know, 27 member states.
Yeah.
But there is a framework for cooperation.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, there have been, you know, we get a lot of inquiries around data transfer or international data transfers. It is a hot topic, I think, with certainly within our customer base. There's no two ways about that. And I think, you know, the last few years has definitely demonstrated there's just been a lot going on in this space. And this is just another, you know, another thing that's happened that supports getting this right. You know, and if you are looking to transfer personal data from one country to another, you need to think about doing it and doing it properly.
Yes. And, you know, it's the requirements around, you know, meeting this is not just about, you know, oh, it's encrypted, we're all good. You know, there's legal frameworks that you may be able to rely on. There could be standard contractual clauses, certification mechanisms, all of those are ways, but they all require a degree of understanding which one you're going to rely on.
As a non-US citizen, are you concerned about your data being processed in the US?
Wow. Okay.
Just throw that one
only because I'm just putting my ESTA visa application in. So thanks for that. All one, right, Ben. Well, at a high level, no, because I think there is a bit of a misconception about data protection in the US. There are a multitude of data protection laws. At a federal and at a state level and at a not so much at a federal, to be fair, but certainly at a state and sector level within the US. So there absolutely is protection. It comes from a different starting point. Rather than the European view of, you know, fundamental rights and freedoms, it's very much around consumer protection and how your rights to privacy relates to that. So it probably reaches the same sort of goal. It just starts at a different point. And, you know, maybe we'll have a discussion around the different types of models that you can find with the US model, which is a mix of sectorial and what we call comprehensive, and what we have in Europe, the comprehensive model, where we say if it's personal information, it's covered by the regulation.
Yeah.
And there are pros and cons to both.
Yeah. Well, I'll make a note. I'll ask that question once you got your ESTA application.
Yeah, yeah. Let me try and get in and get out. That'd be great.
I'll do it after you've returned. How about that? We'll get you back out first. Good. All right.
Material loss.
Wow. Okay.
This is an interesting news update, right?
Mm.
So in this case, if you're using CCTV to train your staff and that CCTV is of a member of staff who isn't aware, is not even present and finds out afterwards because a colleague or some colleagues have then gone, oh yeah, we've just had training on, you know, on a day you weren't in and it was of you. You were, you know, your face was obfuscated, but we could tell it was you and you know, it's fairly obvious.
Yes. And I mean, so that whole sort of lifting the sort of lid on what we mean by non-material material losses as it relates to the GDPR is a really interesting topic, because the regulations always allowed for it. The regulations also allow for what is known as class actions if you're sort of US, or group litigation orders from a sort of EU-UK perspective. Excuse me. So what that means is that it's if it affects more than one individual, all of those individuals can be on the same claim. Now, everybody likes to talk about fines, and we've discussed fines, you know, let's be honest, you know, that's kind of, you know, that's the topic that, you know, maybe gets you in the room and gets a bit of interest, shall we say. But I've always thought that it's this whole idea of non-material losses. Now, there's a lot happening around that. Firstly, we had the Austrian Post Office case, which kind of set the tone on this. So they got fined 18 million. It was about 18 million euros from memory. And what it meant was that it allowed individuals to make a claim for suffering and harm. So it was very much about, look, you know, I have some, I've experienced some concern. But the case of, you know, that's happened really more recently in Ireland, where the chap had been awarded 2,000 euros. Yeah. That's the interesting one, because what it does show, if someone had been able to, you know, so say, look, this has caused me material distress and suffering. Mm. On that basis, you can now make a claim. And we also have a Court of Justice of the EU giving clarification around what's required. So that case is talking about the fact that, one, you have to show a degree. It's not just I'm upset.
Yeah.
There has to be a degree of, like, you know, this has caused me, you know, distress. But it also reinforces this idea of group litigation order. I think the difficulty when I talk to my sort of legal friends around this is it's very difficult to establish that everybody has met that same kind of level of distress. So what I might find distressing, you could be okay with.
Yeah.
And no, I know that because a lot of the things you say to me, I find very distressing, but you're okay with.
I'm more than happy. Yeah. And vice versa.
Absolutely. But yeah.
Yeah. Well, look, I think... I think it's a difficult one. I think, how do you calculate what, you know, non-material loss actually is? I was upset, you know, it caused me sleepless nights. It caused, you know, anxiety, stress, those types of things. How do you put a value on that? And I don't think that's something we can typically answer today, but, you know, that's, I guess, for the courts and
that's for the courts to decide, I think. Mm. I mean, we were seeing it around, I think, about 300 euros-ish. Mm. Per individual. So they can't be, we're not seeing excessive amounts. We're not seeing, you know, the hundreds of millions, the 20 millions. We're seeing it, you know, the 300, you know, 2,000.
If you've got 2,000 euros and you've got particular examples where, you know, that might be times, you know, 10,000, if it's 10,000 people.
That's the point.
Yeah.
That's the killer of the conversation.
Because that gets expensive. Well, there's, I think it's not a new thing, is it? That we're, you know, have you been involved in a data breach? No win, no fee, claim now. You know, that's been around for a little while now. I've seen quite a few of them out there, specialist companies and lawyers that, you know, that will go after those types of claims. But I don't think we've seen a huge amount of those sorts of claims actually come to fruition. So, you know, you're expecting, do you think that's going to increase? Do you think it's going to kind of stay the same? Just continue, feels relatively, from what I'm seeing and from what I'm hearing, it's fairly stable. But is it maybe because it's still in its infancy in terms of actually getting these claims, you know, through courts and out the other side?
Well, we had the Morrison one, which kind of came and then, you know, they didn't go through on appeal. Yeah. I think you probably will see more of them, and I believe that the success rate will go up. So there are some stats around, and I'm not talking just in terms of data protection, but if you look at the stats around how many group litigation orders are, even from the UK's perspective, that is increasing. Yeah. So that, and one of the big reasons why it's increasing is because it's now opt-out rather than opt-in. So that's a subject to talk about consent maybe later.
I can hope.
It's, you know, as if I only have to, I don't actually have to opt-in, just opt-out, to be part of this group litigation order piece, it makes it easier for organisations, companies, individuals that are bringing the case to get the momentum of a number of people.
Yeah. Be good to get a lawyer's view on this, perhaps in the future.
I think we have a few lawyers that are keen to be part of this.
Yeah,
so, yeah, we will be scheduling that and bringing them in.
Great. Sounds good. Angus Council.
Yes, Angus Council. So a recent one, this. Interesting because it was a leak around individuals that were on the Ukrainian settlement homes piece.
Yeah.
From the UK. And this was kind of ended up on a website. Now, interestingly, this...
Oh, was it Facebook?
Yeah.
Facebook group?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, just like, you know, I'm not sure if they've managed to work out what the root cause analysis was of it.
No, it doesn't seem to be clear.
No, and also the fact that it wasn't necessarily a file that was shared and then could be downloaded, but it could be copied. So it wasn't, you know, like you could take it literally a screenshot of it, that sort of thing. And they removed it pretty quickly, to be fair to them. And I don't want to be negative all the time. I'll tell you what I like about this story. It's what I like about it is that they acted really quickly.
Yeah.
You know, they reported themselves to the regulator. They got it down really quickly. They went out and, you know, made the apology. And they're offering support to those that are affected. Now, I'm not exactly entirely sure what that support looks like. I don't know what that, you know, what that kind of means. But maybe that's something we'll talk about later in terms of what do we mean by a privacy harm. But I like the fact they, you know, they took control of the situation. That's how I see it personally.
Yeah, I mean, lessons to be learned, and, you know, not just for them, but, you know, others looking in, outside looking in, can learn lessons from it as well. You know, nothing, you know, not everything always goes to plan, and there will be things that go wrong. And, you know, a lot of the time it's how you deal with those. It's the old saying, isn't it? It's not necessarily what you say, it's how you say it. And the same, I think, applies to events such as that. It's, you know, it's how have you responded to it? We could talk all day about, you know, incident response and breach response and all those types of things. And we see companies do it really well, and we see companies do it really badly.
Oh, yeah. I mean, personally, the way I look at it is you can go from managing the situation, if there's been a breach, to real stewardship.
Yeah.
And if you go from, you know, from just sort of being able to kind of control it and manage it to stewardship, guess what? What you find then is you can actually show how well you're doing things. It's only when you get a complaint and you deal with a complaint effectively that people go, oh, actually, you know what? They're doing well. No one kind of notices how well things are going when it's all smooth.
No.
You know, unlike this podcast. I'm interested on what your thoughts are around surge pricing that Uber use. And I think that's a topical thing with what's going on with, you know, the whole Oasis piece about the surge pricing on the, you know, buying tickets for Oasis. So this is something we're going to see a lot more of. So it's not just purely on demand. There are other factors. Now, I don't know if we can talk about Uber and Oasis in the same context, but what I'm interested in, what your view is, Ben, because I know you've got so many retail clients around, you know, sort of surge pricing and using personal information to determine what someone should be paying.
As a business, you know, is it wrong? And this goes back to, you know, since time began, buying and selling or trading of goods and the supply and demand of those goods, you know, is it wrong to adjust your pricing based on supply and demand? Probably, my view is probably not. I think if you've got a demand for a product, people are prepared to pay for that. You know, as long as it's not, you know, you're not exploiting people per se. You know, it's not, you're not charging people for air and, you know, and excessively charging people for, you know, water and things like that.
Well, that's the interesting piece where you talk about exploiting people. And obviously these are subjects we will be going on to and talking about and covering as, you know, we do more of these. And in fact, I've got a, you know, and I'm sure you have, a couple of people that I know would love to be part of this.
Yeah.
Because they live in that world of AI algorithms, you know, that whole sort of building a profile to determine what you are going to pay. So you're paying a lower price than me based on your profile, but it's kind of okay?
Well, look, I think, you know, the travel industry is a good example where, you know, I don't think anyone on holiday or in a hotel or on a flight, there's not two people that have paid exactly the same. Everyone's paid something either slightly different or maybe even massively different. And that's not a new thing. It's been going on for years and years and years. And I think organizations are now starting to, and have probably been for quite some time, using data and technology to try and be smarter around things like dynamic pricing.
Okay, so the question is then, bringing it back to GDPR, if one of the principles is fairness,
yeah,
when does that dynamic pricing based on an individual's profile become unfair?
So I'm talking about things like, you know, is the company, you know, say Uber, for example, are they busy? You know, that's just them and you know, a particular time. It's not necessarily a specific to an individual, like having a low battery and potentially being quite desperate to get home. Yeah, I think that crosses the line in my mind.
Why?
Because you are exploiting a situation based on a specific individual. So if everybody's on Uber at the same time and it's very busy one particular Saturday night after an Oasis gig, for example, you know,
we're not after free tickets, by the way, but if you do have free tickets, send them through.
We, you know, everyone's prices are inflated because it's busy. That's very different to go and picking people off based on the fact that their phone might be low on battery because they didn't charge it.
Couldn't Uber argue that the risk is high because by the time they get there, the phone might be out and they've lost money on trying to pick up a ride?
Potentially, yeah. I mean, you know, there's going to be lots of arguments for and against, isn't there? Do you think users will likely agree, and they may not have a choice if they want to use the app, to these sorts of terms? And are they even aware of things like this?
Well, that comes into another principle of GDPR, transparency.
Yeah.
So, you know, you cannot have fairness without transparency. Mm. You can't say that you're being treated fairly. To my mind, fairly is when you are treated differently because of characteristics which shouldn't really affect, you know. For example, if you went to obtain a loan and based on your postcode, you'd pay a higher rate for that loan, that's really unfair in my mind. And in fact, that's what some US banks were doing previously. And that's kind of, you know, being wrapped up now. But that's where I think, you know, fairness and unfairness as it relates to the general data protection regulation comes in.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, as we move forward, that's a topic we can certainly, you know, revisit. Mm. And there are lots of people that have views on that.
Yeah. I you know, we come across lots of conversations like this in various organisations. We're definitely seeing a continued increase in how do we maximise the value of data, whether that be personal data or other types of business or financial data, to drive efficiencies, to get the most out of it, you know, to increase profits, drive revenue. All those types of things are obviously important to most businesses, most commercial, privately owned, public listed businesses. You know, they are there to you know, return to return profits to their owners and to their investors and their shareholders. So, you know, coming up with methods and ways to drive that business through the use of data is only going one way, as we know, and as most people are aware of. It's where do you draw the line? What's right and what's wrong? What's ethical and what's, you know, what's lawful? And there's all, putting all those into the mix. And I think, you know, some companies are undoubtedly going to get it wrong. And I think some will find and strike the right balance.
We haven't even mentioned yet the word AI.
No.
So that's definitely going to be a big topic, and where privacy and how data protection and privacy and the intersection of that will start to, you know, really be challenging. Yeah. For both developers and deployers of AI tooling.
Yeah. So we're getting a lot of questions and inquiries and, you know, support around what internal policy should look like around the use of AI. And we've seen, you know, big organizations, some have banned it, some have put heavy guidance around, you know, the mainstream platforms, like, you know, what are staff allowed to use it? What data can they put in it? It's shadow IT, you know, essentially, isn't it? All over again, really. And it's, you know, you've got these third-party platforms that aren't in control of the business, and, you know, you've essentially got the risk of staff putting data in, I suspect largely for good reason, and for efficiencies. Is that a good thing? What is that data? How risk is it to the, you know, all these sorts of things are still really being worked out, let alone, you know, the creation and the development of AI within organizations. This is just, you know, tools, AI tooling that's just readily available out there for anyone, in most cases free of charge, that you can go and use. And we're already seeing lots of data being put into those.
Absolutely. And, you know, definitely a topic for, you know, another day.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. So I want to come on to, you know, consultancy. You know, you've spent a long time in the industry.
No need to be rude.
What makes a good consultant?
From whose perspective? From the client's perspective?
From both. Or, well, I'll ask you as well, what makes a good client?
Oh, okay.
But we'll come on to that.
Okay. So what makes a good consultant?
As a head of data protection, you know, what do you look for in terms of an individual, in terms of their skill set, you know, their experience, their personality, the background, all of those, you know, factors where you can look at someone and go, you know, you would be good in, maybe not all, but the vast majority situations and scenarios and accounts and customers, because it is a tough game. Consultancy Definitely. Is a tough game, and I think a lot of people underestimate it. I've seen some very good consultants and I've seen some not so good ones over the years. You know, having the ability to kind of dip in and out of different organizations, you know, and understand the culture, the technology, the strategy, you know, there's lots of things. And then to kind of come out of that environment and then go into a different organization, say the next day, and deliver another piece of work where all of those components, all of those things change. You know, it is quite a difficult thing to actually be very good at.
Yes. So in terms of, you know, consultancy and advisory work, the first thing to understand is that as a consultant, you are an expert in a particular area. Yeah. And, you know, by looking at when we say an expert, it means you know a lot about a specific subject. So the more expertise you become, the more you become entrenched and understand the fundamentals, the requirements, the needs, the nuances, the changes in that subject. And for myself and the team, it's privacy, it's data protection, it's global data protection laws, etc. Now, that's the baseline of, you know, what you need. That gets you to the position where you are a competent consultant, in my mind. What makes a good consultant is being able to take that expertise and not just recite it. You know, because if that's what you're after, go to Google, go to ChatGPT. You know, that's not going to cut it. You need to understand what the requirements are from the organization. So an organization will, you know, and we talk about understanding the business sector, understanding, you know, the goals of the organization. So you do have to be a bit multifaceted to be able to deliver the core of your knowledge. Yeah. However, what really is the question that every consultant should be asking themselves on any engagement, certainly when it comes to data protection and privacy, is this: what impact is my advice going to have, either positively or negatively? Because your advice will have an impact. It's going to maybe change how that organization operates. It might lead to redundancies. It might lead to people being recruited. There's a lot of, you know, not just business impacts, but actually on a human level, your advice can materially change how that's going to affect someone.
Yeah.
So I'm not, you know, well, I'm not saying, like, you know, we're doctors or anything like that. You know, I wouldn't be that sort of arrogant. But, you know, if you don't understand the worth and the value in what you do, why is your client going to believe it? Why is your client going to actually think, yeah, what this guy is saying or what this lady is saying has an impact to me? Because if you don't think about what that's going to mean, yeah, why would they?
And I think a lot of it comes back to trust. You know, can your client trust you? And I think, you know, we've got an excellent, you know, track record, and, you know, we've got very good relationships, fantastic relationships with our clients, and they're all built on trust. And they, you know, the advice that we give, okay, you know, not all of the time is it listened to, because there are other competing aspects, you know, that the business has to take into account. But a majority of the time, you know, there's a lot of advice that's given. There's a lot of trust there. And I think that, you know, it comes back to things like, you know, integrity and credibility. And that those are all, you know, underlying aspects that build up that trust, that actually the advice and the guidance that customers and organizations are paying for, you know, they're getting good value for it, and it's in the best interest of them.
100%. And credibility is important.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's one, I think one area why, you know, Blackfoot and GDPR.ai have done so well.
One of the main unique situations with the Blackfoot approach and, you know, GDPR IE approach is this. Typical consultancy is you have an engagement, you go in, you understand the business, you understand the requirements, and you deliver that expertise advice. Then in a lot of traditional models, that consultant will leave. Now, what that kind of means is this. We're cooking the meal, we don't have to taste it.
Yeah.
Our approach is different. So we not only provide the advisory and the consultancy work, we do the whole wraparound where we work with the client based on the advice we give. So we're kind of living and dying on what we say. If we're saying you should do A, B, and C, and you as a client then says, okay, great, I want you to, you know, come with us with A and B or B and C. If we've got it wrong, we're on that ride. We're sitting down having that meal with them.
Yeah.
So that's the big difference. And that's why we really have to... I'm not suggesting that any consultant anywhere would go and give, you know, advice flippantly because they're kind of leaving. But it's a core imperative piece for us because we're on the journey with the client.
Yeah.
In most cases, not all cases, but in most cases.
Yeah, I mean, I've had many conversations over the years where there's a real benefit between, you know, do we build up internal capability exclusively, by and large? And there is a strong argument that every time someone is hired in a senior position around data protection and information security, they leave and they take their strategy with them. It's less common, from what I've seen over the last decade, that a new senior stakeholder comes in and they just adopt the same strategy. We see it all the time. You know, first 90 days, first 100 days, what are you going to do? Well, I'm going to assess the business, going to understand what I need, and then I'm going to create a strategy and off I go. You know, that's fairly common, I think.
Why do you think that is? Why, when a new sort of head of comes into a business, why do they want to change what was there?
Well, perhaps that's their mandate. You know, perhaps things... I think it depends on why the last person left. You know, if it wasn't working out and they were taking their particular area of the business into a different direction, or it wasn't delivering results, or perhaps, you know, it wasn't aligned to, you know, the business strategy. It could be lots of different reasons. I think if things were working well and, you know, it was quite a successful stakeholder that just decided to move on for their own reasons... It feels like most of the time the new person comes in and they've got something to prove, haven't they? And, you know, they've come in as a senior stakeholder. They're going to want to take things in their direction. It might not always mean drastic change, but there is always change. It's a different person, not, you know, humans, it's human nature not to be the same, obviously. And then we see lots of change, you know, and how that impacts, you know, things like a data protection program, an information security program, can potentially have quite a big knock-on effect.
Well, I'll tell you why, is because if you look at it, and this is the whole area of data protection, some of it's really, and I'm, you know, be honest, really easy, because it's, you can do this, you can't do that. If you're looking at it from a compliance model perspective. However, it's for nuances, it's for shade of grey. And we just, you know, we had a discussion about what is fairness.
Yeah.
Well, you've got to take that and then translate it into, you know, deliverables and actions that an organization can understand and implement. Yeah, you can't have corporations at every decision-making point having discussions about, well, what is fairness? Yeah, where does the ethics come into it? You've got to take this, agree a position, and then, you know, implement that. The difficulty is that those, you know, ideas of, you know, what is acceptable, what isn't acceptable, and it's not just about the regulation, it's about expectations of individuals, employees, customers, consumers, patients, whatever you want to, you know, call individuals. Is it meeting their expectations as well? So it's a bit of, there's some nuance there, and that needs to be agreed. And that's why I believe, personally, when someone else comes in, it might not just be ego, where you go, I'm the new guy, I'm going to change everything. It's more about, actually, I see it differently, so we need to change.
Yeah, I get that. And I think, you know, depending on the circumstances, as I've already said, you know, it depends on, it will be dependent on whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. And I think, you know, where we've done a lot of work with customers in the past and continue to do so is ensuring that, you know, as people come and go, the strategy remains intact. And that's something we bring to the table, because we drive and develop and create the strategy.
Sure.
So people can come and go and you haven't got this big change. Yeah, if that's appropriate.
Yeah. So I've been Shahbaz Baghdadi. Thank you for watching the Privacy Impact Shop, and hope to hear from you soon.
And I'm Ben Stevens. If you enjoyed listening or watching, please subscribe and also follow us on LinkedIn. Thank you.